From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the standoff in Waco, Texas continues, we talk with Robert J. Lifton about why certain people are drawn to cult groups and apocalyptic thinking. Lifton has been studying cults for over 10 years. Also today, what's wrong with America's health insurance system? We get a diagnosis and prescription from Mark Roberts of the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. And the latest movie to satirize the music world, CB4. It's the Spinal Tap of rap, or is it? Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An anti-abortion protester is jailed without bond on murder charges in Pensacola, Florida, in yesterday's shooting death of a doctor outside an abortion clinic. Debbie Elliott reports from Pensacola.
A bouquet of flowers has been set on the sidewalk behind Pensacola Women's Medical Services, where Dr. David Gunn was shot 3 times in the back as he arrived for work Wednesday morning. 31-year-old Michael Griffin is being held without bail on a murder charge after telling police he shot Dr. Gunn. Pensacola Police Sergeant Jerry Potts says Griffin is affiliated with the anti-abortion group which was protesting at the clinic during the shooting, and investigators are trying to determine whether he acted alone.
Well, I'm saying at this time we have no evidence to indicate a conspiracy exists. However, we will continue to investigate.
During a video hearing from his jail cell early today, Griffin told the judge he wants to be his own attorney and requested that he be able to keep a Bible in his cell as a legal document. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic apparently resisted pressure from international envoys today and declined to use his influence to help end the fighting in Bosnia. Milosevic, whose government has been widely accused of supporting ethnic Serbian fighters in Bosnia, said today in Paris that he has only limited influence over the Bosnian Serbs. Milosevic said that a solution must be reached among the 3 warring parties in Bosnia, and he called for an unconditional ceasefire. The Serbian president met today with UN Representative Cyrus Vance and Lord David Owen, the mediator for the European Community, as well as French President François Mitterrand. The Russian Congress of People's Deputies has completed the second day of an emergency session in Moscow, and although the Congress has modified a draft bill to severely limit the powers of President Boris Yeltsin, Yeltsin seems certain to come out of the Congress greatly weakened. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
There was no let-up today in the Congress's attacks on Boris Yeltsin and his economic reform package. Despite an appeal from Yeltsin himself for compromise and dialogue, Congress Speaker Ruslan Hasbulatov's withering condemnation of Yeltsin's policies left no doubt that the Congress does not intend to meet Yeltsin halfway. The Congress is now considering a draft bill that will cancel a referendum in April that was designed to resolve the debilitating conflicts over power that have nearly paralyzed the Russian government. In addition, the bill will reactivate amendments to the Russian Constitution that permit the parliament greater freedom to block Yeltsin's initiatives, especially in economic reform, and allow the parliament to remove Yeltsin from office by a simple vote without an impeachment trial. The Congress is expected to adopt this bill tomorrow, and it appears Yeltsin has no chance to prevent its passage. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, the Dow Jones lost more than 21 points today. This is NPR. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt called on Congress today to change the laws on staking mining claims and to tax gold and other minerals found on federal lands. Babbitt also said that he'll prevent any new land patents from being rushed through to escape new mining restrictions. The secretary said that hundreds of millions of dollars in potential revenue are lost to the U.S. Treasury from resources that are mined on federal lands. Babbitt said the administration wants a 12.5% royalty on minerals extracted on federal lands. Under the current law, mining claims can be patented for as little as $2.50 an acre. A survey released today says Americans aren't taking very good care of their health. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Every year for the past 10 years, the polling firm Lewis Harris & Associates has asked Americans about their health habits. The 1992 results, released today, show slippage. More Americans are overweight. Fewer are exercising or eating fiber. More confess to feeling stressed out and driving at over the speed limit. But some public health efforts have evidently been effective. More Americans than ever before are shunning tobacco. More are using seatbelts. Fewer are drinking. And more women are checking their breasts for breast cancer. The pollsters report a lot of good intentions. 7 of 10 smokers say they want to quit, and over half of those surveyed who don't exercise regularly want to start. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Retail sales were up slightly in February despite a big drop in the sales of new cars. The Commerce Department reported that sales were up by 0.3% in February after flat growth in January and a strong December. Analysts said the slower pace of growth at the retail level was caused in part by winter weather and consumer worry about jobs. Sales of new cars fell by 2.2%. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cult leader David Koresh, dozens of his followers, and some of their children remain holed up in their compound in Waco, Texas. Koresh preaches that the end of the world is near and that he is the Messiah. How do cult leaders like Koresh win the complete and unquestioning faith of their followers? My guest Robert J. Lifton has been studying cult groups for over a decade. He's also studied fundamentalist religions, and he's done pioneering work on the psychological impact of living in the presence of nuclear weapons. Lifton directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the City University of New York John Jay College. He's also a distinguished professor of psychiatry and psychology. I spoke with him yesterday and asked if the Branch Davidians represent a certain type of cult.
In terms of their structure, they're a very typical cult. And the way that one can say that, or the criteria one can use to call them a cult, include a charismatic leader with more or less complete control over a particular group of people, and a process by which gradually the worship of spiritual principles gives way to the worship of the particular leader. That, along with certain thought reform-like or so-called brainwashing-like procedures, which one suspects are used there, can enable one to call this a cult. And there's a third dimension, too, and that has to do with what's often a genuine religious quest from below on the part of ordinary members, with considerable exploitation from above. That exploitation can be economic or, as it is in this case, sexual. So those qualities are very typical of a cult. But in addition, this particular cult has a very intense end-time ideology, and it also has a very intense immersion in a gun culture.
Yeah, well, this cult prophesies the end of the world. What do you think is the appeal of end-of-the-world thinking?
End-of-the-world thinking is very widespread throughout the world, but perhaps especially in the United States. It has enormous appeal because at a time of apocalyptic threat, whether from nuclear weapons or the destruction of the environment, there is the promise of a form of immortality. There is also a kind of theory which may sound absurd to many of us, but can have some appeal because it seems to explain indications of apocalyptic events. And people who embrace end time really take it as part of their sense of self, live with it, and draw certain psychological benefits from it.
What are the psychological benefits you get from thinking that you and everybody else are going to be dead soon?
Well, by and large, you think that you are going to survive.
Right.
That is, with this kind of end-time theology, there is an interpretation of the book of Revelation. And that interpretation says that there are a series of events which lead up to the end time, or end times, as it's sometimes called. And the indications are the various expressions of evil and destructiveness around us. And in that process, there will be a tremendous upheaval in which everybody who has not prepared himself or herself by a particular embrace of a religious point of view will be destroyed. But those who have prepared themselves in the correct way will be raptured up, that is, literally taken up to heaven and enabled to survive. So there is an actual belief in a literal form of immortality that this end time ideology permits one.
If you go back through recent history and look at religions and cults that believe in end-of-the-world thinking, is there any division you see in the era right before and right after the atom bomb?
Oh, yes. Certainly one can say something like this, whether or not it has occurred directly after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the first and so far only use of atomic weapons on human populations. Whether it has occurred right after that, it's hard to say, but certainly since that time, with the continuous threat of nuclear annihilation, there has been a radical expansion of fundamentalism in general, and I mean fundamentalism of all the great religions, not just Christian fundamentalism. One could speak of a worldwide epidemic of fundamentalism, so that whereas in the past, Christian fundamentalism, at least that espoused end-time ideology seriously and in a literal way, in the past, that was very much marginal or on the fringe. Now it has become something close to the mainstream and extraordinarily widespread in numbers, in influence, and in its general impact on the culture, so that it's very likely that although nuclear weapons in no way created fundamentalism, that has much older origins, certainly the combination of nuclear weapons and other apocalyptic threats of destruction, those have had a tremendous influence on the expansion and spread and unprecedented influence of end-of-the-world imagery and fundamentalism that espouses that imagery.
If you're just joining us, my guest is psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who is a professor at the City University of New York, where he directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival. He's been studying cult groups and fundamentalist religions for many years. You have been studying both fundamentalist religions and cults. What, if anything, do those two groups have in common?
Well, what they have in common is an inclination toward totalism. My very first study was of Chinese thought reform, or so-called brainwashing. And in that book that I wrote, a book called Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, there was a chapter toward the end of the book in which I listed and described eight themes or characteristics of a totalistic environment or of ideologies that veered toward totalism. And it was interesting that years later, people who had left the cults, various cults in the United States, and their parents took up that chapter and found these eight principles to apply exactly to what they'd been through. And some cults took up the chapter also because they wanted to claim that they weren't guilty of these themes of totalism. So that there is a common issue of totalism here for any environment that tries to coercively affect people. And that's true of both cults and of many fundamentalist environments. They also may both embrace end-time imagery or end-time ideology and look to the end of the world. Most of the intense cults have some such ideology or a version of it. And very often, with a cult, the particular leader, who's likely to be right there among them, is seen as the Messiah or as someone very close to the Messiah, or either as Jesus or a Jewish version of the Messiah or whatever. This, of course, would be not the case with fundamentalist religion. But the totalism and the end time issues are very central to both of them.
Have you studied what type of people are inclined to join cults?
From what I've learned about that, yes. Many different kinds of people, especially young people, have been attracted to cults. They've been most vulnerable when they've been in some kind of transition in their lives, a little bit confused or uncertain about their future. They needn't have any special kind of pathology, though some of them can have difficulty functioning except in a very dependent environment, which is what a cult certainly provides. But you don't have to be a special kind of person to have joined a cult. You may be a person who has been in a life crisis or has been at a certain moment of need, and you may even be what I call a protean person, a person who is a searcher and who experiments with the self. And the cult may be one such experiment, but it's one that's hard to get out of once you enter it for various psychological and physical reasons.
Why is it hard to get out of a cult?
In some of the cult practices, certainly in the past, and they've tried to modify them because they've been sources of prosecution, there have been elements of systematic deception. That is, people were taken to places. First of all, they were told that this is just a young group of people who like to talk about spiritual things, and they weren't identified properly. They were sometimes taken to very removed environments where it was very hard to, from which it was very hard to leave, and they were then subjected to intense forms of persuasion, and sometimes they would be there for the alleged seminar was to last over days or weeks. So it could be physically hard to leave, but even where it isn't physically hard to leave, it can be psychologically very hard to leave as one gets into a totalized environment. One of the, or the prerequisite for totalism, as I explained it or came to recognize, is what I call milieu control, which is the control of all communication within an environment. And when that happens, one internalizes the ideas of a cult, and one is made to feel there are other characteristics, what I call mystical manipulation, a quest for purity, and a cult of confession. And when all these are operating, one begins to feel that it's wrong to try to leave the cult, and one's guilt is manipulated by the cult leader or leaders. And there's another theme of what I call doctrine over person, so that if one begins to have doubts, one attributes them to one's own shortcomings or one's own evil, rather than to the shortcomings of the doctrine or the behavior of the cult leader or others in the cult. There's also in this environment of totalism, and you find it in cults, and you find it in some fundamentalist groups as well, what I call sacred science. They claim to have the truth about humankind, and the claim is both religious and, in this particular era, scientific, at least as they put it forward. And there's also what I call the loading of the language, a certain sort of language which limits your thought process. So for all these reasons, it can be hard to formulate any point of view outside of the cult's beliefs. And finally, in these environments of totalism, you get the worst feature of all, what I call the dispensing of existence.
What does that mean?
Well, in forms of, in expressions of political totalism and some religious extremism, you can actually kill someone if he or she deviates from what's considered truth and goodness. But more frequently, it isn't that extreme, but it means that one is viewed as not having the right to exist, and one can internalize that view that should one leave the cult, one would no longer exist in a spiritual or psychological sense. One would be simply lifeless and without any meaning in one's life, and one would be worthless, so that the dispensing of existence becomes a powerful process that can be internalized and can be still another force that keeps people in cults.
You know, some parents, for instance, who've tried to get their children out of cults have hired deprogrammers to lift all the mind control techniques that have influenced the person in the cult. What do you think of deprogramming?
Well, deprogramming is a very unfortunate term because it sounds like another form of manipulation. I think now people who do this work prefer to call themselves exit counselors. And I think those who are most sensitive, and there are some who have thought a lot about this with considerable sensitivity, they no longer, you know, bring about any coercive measures or the old stories about kidnapping people coming out of cults. They replace that with efforts at persuasion where they can at least make contact with people from cults. And they try to combine various forms of biblical examination with something like a form of psychotherapy. And that can be, I think, a constructive process.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton, and he's a psychiatrist who directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the City University of New York John Jay College. And he's been studying cults and fundamentalist religions for many years. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Robert J. Lifton. He's a psychiatrist who's been studying fundamentalist religions and cults for many years. How do you think the FBI and the ATF have been handling the Branch Davidians?
Well, it's hard to pass judgment from a distance, but I think that the initial assault was unfortunate because it seemed to bear out the fantasy of an end-time battle. Some other method should have been, if at all possible, made use of. As far as their negotiating, that's difficult, and it's hard to criticize that from a distance. I think the very recent information about their bringing in somebody whom Koresh knows and may even have some sympathy for, one of the sheriffs whom he's known in the past, that's a good idea. And I think their effort now to resolve the thing peaceably is to be commended. I'm not so sure about the logic of bringing up those powerful Abrams tanks, because it again is a kind of process of a battle. And even though I understand their rationale for it, it might be questioned for that reason.
But, you know, a cult leader who thinks that he's basically the Messiah is about the last person you're going to convince to change his mind.
Well, one hopeful aspect here, you really get indications with Koresh of two different selves within him, so to speak. One is the claim of being the Messiah, of being the Lamb of God, the sense of omnipotence that he carries about as cult leader. The other is the man who's asking in a nitty-gritty way what he and others will be accused of and what their sentences would be, that is, who's negotiating about his immediate fate in a practical way. The second nitty-gritty self is the hopeful one about negotiations, and we don't know which one will prevail, therefore we don't know how the situation will end.
Koresh is one of the cult leaders who expects sex from some of his followers.
Yes.
And he's had many wives over the years. What do you understand about that connection between cult leaders and sex with their followers?
Well, there's a lot of that among cult leaders and sex with their followers. Sex is relegated to the mystical realm, and the godlike or messiah-like leader is considered to have all rights over anyone in that group, and women who are true believers may feel privileged to be sought by the Messiah. At another level, it's characteristic of what I called the genuine quest from below and the exploitation from above. In the case of Koresh, you have the sense of a man who has been sexually active and has exploited members of his cult for a long time, as long as he's been able to, and in fact made his way into leadership of the cult through his sexual prowess or his sexual inclinations. There was a story about how he had relations with the former leader of the cult, who had been the wife of the leader who died, and she had taken over. He was in his 20s and she was in her 60s. When he initiated a sexual relationship with her, and the man he had a power struggle with was her son, who is now in a mental hospital and who resented Koresh both for seeking power and for having this relationship with his mother. So the sexual dimension is very central with Koresh, and it's a source of his power, and it's also an expression of exploitation from above.
Have you ever had any friends, close friends or relatives who either were in cults or who had children who joined cults?
Yes, I have had friends and acquaintances whose children have joined cults. And it's a devastating experience for parents, especially parents who see themselves as having had liberal convictions and having tried to bring up their children to be open-minded. And it's shocking when these same children can join cults and seem to come to stand for everything antagonistic to what the parents have stood for.
What words of advice or comfort do you usually offer the friends?
Well, there's no absolute comfort. One potentially comforting kind of statement is that young people don't necessarily stay in cults forever. Quite a number of them do eventually leave. And many of the cults have taken on a certain amount of economic strength, but in many cases they have difficulty now finding new members. As more and more knowledge of cult formation is available to Americans, including young Americans, it becomes harder for the cults to recruit people. I think the knowledge of what the cults are and what they do can serve to protect people in some degree from vulnerability to their methods. And the whole process is not airtight. Thought reform is not something that works in every way in any absolute sense. People have doubts. I think that there in that Waco, Texas compound, there are some people who would like to be outside of it and who have inner doubts. And we see that manifested sometimes when there are court cases and when people, young people, just leave the cult or even walk to the opposite table in a courtroom. They seem to quickly change, or there is a second self. I see this as a kind of doubling in which one self can embrace the cult, and there can be an earlier sense of self that has been in some ways muted but hasn't been entirely destroyed, which can reemerge so that a person can come out of a cult in a third place, drawing upon some of that earlier non-cult self. None of this is an absolute foolproof process in whatever thought reform or brainwashing-like methods may be used.
So for someone who's leaving a cult, is learning to live with doubt one of the most difficult parts?
It can be indeed. And for people leaving cults, they go through a phase, and it can last for months or even years, of moments of nostalgia for that satisfaction of dependency and for the time of living in the cult when life seemed a little bit easier in certain ways. But they can also gradually take on more autonomy and almost all make their peace with life outside the cult and move on to other things. And people can do that, and they do it all the time.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us about your research.
You're very welcome.
Robert J. Lifton directs the Center on Violence and Human Survival at the City University of New York John Jay College. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Why are health insurance premiums so high? Coming up, we look at some of the problems with our health insurance system and get some suggestions for change. We talk with Mark Roberts of the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, CB4. It's a hip-hop parody starring Chris Rock and Phil Hartman of Saturday Night Live. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. NATO is making plans to deploy troops in Bosnia to help enforce a peace agreement there if one is ever reached. There's a disagreement over who would command the peacekeeping forces. However, U.S. officials say this can be worked out. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The issue of command is complicated because both NATO and the United Nations would be involved in the peacekeeping operation. France, which belongs to NATO but does not accept NATO command, would prefer UN supervision. The United States would prefer a NATO command because NATO has a proven track record and because the ranking officer in NATO is a U.S. general. Another question is how Russian peacekeeping troops would be commanded. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher.
The preliminary planning has begun at NATO with French participation in that. And all these issues we think can be worked out. They're not impeding the progress so far.
U.S. officials discount press reports that under NATO plans, some 20,000 American peacekeeping troops would go to Bosnia. U.S. officials say no precise figures have been decided. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Top U.N. officials say that aid efforts now underway in Bosnia are not enough for two-thirds of the people living there, and that various factions are holding at least 2,500 people prisoner. In Bosnia, several thousand Muslims have taken a number of British troops hostage after they served as escorts to an aid convoy to the area. One military official calls the situation extremely critical. In Los Angeles, a medical expert took the stand today in the federal civil rights trial of four L.A. police officers accused of beating Rodney King. However, before the jury entered the courtroom, one defense attorney asked the judge to strike King's testimony about alleged racial slurs. Kitty Feldy of member station KCRW reports from Los Angeles.
On the stand, biomechanics expert Dr. Harry Smith testified that the injuries to King's face were caused by baton blows, not by a fall to the ground, an assertion made by defense attorneys. Earlier in the day, defense attorney Harlan Braun accused the prosecution of misconduct, allowing Rodney King to testify about racial slurs when he was uncertain whether officers were chanting killer or nigger. Judge John Davies refused to strike the testimony. Outside the courthouse, Braun stuck to his opinion.
To use that word in this case, at this time, in this city, was misconduct, and I just disagree with the judge. I hope that time doesn't prove me too correct, that it was misconduct.
For the second day in a row, defense attorney press briefings have been interrupted by angry private citizens who've accused the attorneys of lying. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 22 points to close at 3,457 on volume of more than 251 million shares. This is NPR News. The Senate has confirmed the nomination of Janet Reno as U.S. Attorney General by a vote of 98-0. She is expected to be sworn into office next week, thus completing President Clinton's cabinet. Reno has been a state prosecutor in Dade County, Florida, for the last 15 years. The Senate waived its usual 3-day waiting period in order to vote on the nomination, less than 24 hours after Reno was approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Reno said her philosophy on running the Department of Justice will be to strive for better cooperation among federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies without regard for credit or turf battles. The House has voted to go along with the Senate and ban immigrants who are HIV positive from entering the country. The vote was a setback for President Clinton, who promised to lift the ban during his campaign. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The vote in the House was an overwhelming 356 to 58. It followed a similar lopsided vote in the Senate. Republican Congressman Gerald Solomon of New York spoke for many when he argued removing the ban would jeopardize public health and the budget.
And lifting the present restrictions will not only place healthy American citizens at higher risk, but it will also strain existing resources that are already so terribly overtaxed. We're going to be debating that all next week.
House and Senate negotiators will now sit down to work out differences between the bills passed by the two chambers. They could decide to keep the ban in place while agreeing to study the issue as a way of saving face for the president. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The government says the number of people filing first-time claims for jobless benefits moved up late last month by 25,000. The Labor Department says some of this increase was in part tied to a return to a normal work week after a shorter reporting period the previous week. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For years, my guest has been asking the same question that Hillary Rodham Clinton is trying to answer now. How can we best reform America's health care system? But my guest, Mark Roberts, wonders if Clinton's task force will have the political will to do what needs to be done. Roberts advocates universal health insurance, one system that everyone would belong to, that would establish a single payer for all health care and do away with much of the current health insurance industry. The Clinton task force is heading in the direction of managed competition between different health plans. Roberts is a professor of political economy and health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. Most people seem to agree that a new system should give everyone access to basic health care. I asked Roberts what is meant by basic health care.
Well, I think it's easier to say what's not in basic health care than to list everything that is in basic health care. What's not, I think, in basic health care is surgery when you're 82 years old for malignancy and bowel obstruction, and you've been operated on four times already, and it's highly unlikely that you'll survive yet another surgical encounter. That kind of thing, where we spend a great deal of money on people whose lives are clearly almost over, I think it should not be part of basic health care. In the United States, we have this neurosis. We seem to think death is avoidable, and we spend a lot of money trying to avoid it when we really shouldn't. One thing that would be in basic health care is routine access to a competent family physician or general practitioner for routine care of normal medical problems, like the complications of diabetes or hypertension, so that we'd try to shift our resources much more into paying for everyday things and leave the really exotic stuff for which there's relatively low payout, leave that out of a basic health care system. The one thing we have to understand is we cannot afford as a country to do everything for everybody that some brilliant young medical scientist somewhere has invented. We have some of the smartest people in America developing new medical technology, and they develop new things all the time. And simply because we can do it doesn't mean that we're going to be able to afford to do it for everybody.
I think the concerns many of us have about health insurance is choice. You know, for instance, the way it stands now, some HMOs, you know, you can't really choose your doctor. You have to select from a certain list of doctors that are affiliated with the plan. How much choice do you think there should be in a healthcare system?
I actually think there should be a lot of choice, and I think choice is an important value. And that's one reason why, if we had a single unified government-financed insurance scheme, I think we'd be better off. The kinds of ideas that are being talked about in Washington these days with regard to managed competition actually would often wind up limiting people's choice. The advantage of a single universal system is that a patient can essentially go anywhere he or she wants. You pick the doctor you want, you pick the hospital you want, you go where you want. And if there's a single comprehensive system, all the physicians are included in a single pool and all the patients are included in a single pool. A universal system does not mean government provision of care. It really means just government financing of care, and we continue to have the private practice of medicine. If you do go to some sort of managed competition system, then what you're essentially doing is creating a set of competing HMOs. And each one of these vertically integrated healthcare systems would have only a limited set of physicians and hospitals that would be part of their system. And a customer would have to choose among one of a limited set of mutually exclusive doctors. And if a given group failed to qualify in a given year, that is, if one of these vertically integrated systems no longer was part of the comprehensive plan, you'd have to switch doctors. Or if your employer switched insurance plans, you would have to switch physicians. And I think Americans really don't want to be coerced with regard to their choice of providers. And the only way to really do that is to have a single comprehensive insurance system.
The president's task force on national health care seems to be heading toward managed competition.
Yeah, that's everybody who is reading the tea leaves is coming to that conclusion. It's watching the task force now is a little like what used to be called Kremlinology. You know, you see who sits next to whom and who walks into the meetings out with whom in order to assess the relative importance of different factions. But that's what I hear.
If we were working in a managed competition system and I were unemployed, would it be any easier for me to get health insurance?
Well, that's one of the interesting questions, because one of the things we know about people who are currently uninsured is that they tend to move in and out of employment status a lot. They're marginal. You know, they work a couple months in a fast food enterprise, and then they're unemployed for a while, and then maybe in the wintertime they work on a ski lift, and then they're unemployed, and then maybe they work on a fishing boat. They move around a lot. And so one of the problems any managed competition system has to deal with is, what provision do you make as people move into and out of various statuses? Do you have to change which plan they're in? Because if you have a special plan for the uninsured or a different deal for the uninsured than you do for people in marginal enterprises, how do you keep track of all that? Again, more paperwork. On the other hand, if you have a single universal system, I have my card and I need care and I pick my doctor in my hospital and I go get care. And you're out of this terrible administrative burden of having to track everybody who every time they change employment status.
My guest is Mark Roberts, a professor of political economy and health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mark Roberts. Let's look at some of the problems with our health care system today. Insurance premiums have gone up so high. And if you're unemployed and you're trying to independently buy insurance, well, you're kind of in trouble. How did premiums get to be so high? Why are they so out of control?
Actually, it's a question I now feel personally, since my eldest daughter was this summer unemployed and I needed to get health insurance for her. So I really have an extreme personal appreciation of this that my academic understanding didn't extend to until recently. It's amazing how high premiums have gone. And the reason in part is that health insurance companies pool risks. And yet, in fact, healthcare is not really an insurable risk. We use an insurance mechanism, but it's really not insurable in the following sense. Insurance is there for unanticipated bad events. You get hit by lightning. The problem is, most people know whether or not they're more likely than average to be sick next year. How do I know if I'm going to be sick next year? Answer, if I'm already sick. If I already have an existing chronic condition, diabetes, hypertension, cancer, HIV, whatever. So that the people who aggressively pursue purchasing insurance tend to be disproportionately people who know they need it. They know they're sick. When the insurance company pools all these self-selected individuals together into a risk pool for the purposes of setting a rate, the individual insurance pool, that pool turns out to be very sick because it's been self-selected in just that way. And so the rate you have to charge anyone who wants to get into that pool is extraordinarily high. As a result, everybody who feels they're pretty healthy and that they can get away probably without insurance because they're unlikely to be sick, those people decide not to buy insurance because it's a bad deal for them. So the average degree of illness in the pool only gets worse. This is called in health insurance the adverse selection death spiral, a rather nice term. And what is going on all across America is healthy people, again, in the jargon of the industry, are going bare. They're going without insurance. The people who are buying insurance are sick people, and the costs of their care are relatively high.
What are some of the alternatives around that?
Well, I really think that the only alternative is to essentially move away from an insurance basis for financing care. Insurance is a very odd scheme because it says, at best, everybody pays the same, rich and poor. The United States is the only country in the world that tries to finance health care in a way that pays no attention to individual income. Every other industrial country in the world finances it heavily out of the tax base, a payroll tax or some other way, that pays attention to how much money people have. In England, when Margaret Thatcher tried to finance basic local services on the basis of a tax that was the same for everybody, a head tax, she got thrown out as the leader of the Conservative Party in England because it was seen as so inequitable. Well, in the United States, an insurance premium-based system is financing health care on the basis of a head tax. And the alternative is to finance it on the basis of something that responds to people's income level, some sort of a payroll tax instead. And that way, poor people who can't afford insurance premiums equal to the expected cost of their care get subsidized. And that's only possible if you move to a universal system.
If we were to have a universal health care system like you're proposing, we'd need to raise more money to support it. One way to get some money is the payroll tax, which you're suggesting. The President's Task Force on National Health Care Reform seems to be looking seriously at taxes on alcohol, cigarettes, possibly taxes on guns. What do you think of that form of raising money?
Well, I'm all in favor of these so-called sin taxes, but I doubt when you do the arithmetic that they can actually raise the amount of money that's needed. Notice under a universal health plan, you would raise taxes, but on the other hand, you would do away with the current tax of health insurance premiums. If you've looked at your paycheck recently and you've seen how much of your paycheck goes to pay for your health insurance benefits, you'd see that there's a pretty substantial trade-off that's possible there by trading in the current amounts you pay in return for contributing in a payroll tax. These so-called sin taxes, by the way, I should say I think the president has made a factual error here. He said that cigarettes raise the costs of the healthcare system, and I know it's unfashionable given for somebody who comes in part from a public health background to say this. But the actual fact of the matter is that healthcare costs would go up if everybody stopped smoking. At least that's what my own estimates suggest. And the reason is that, in fact, cigarettes kill you, and they tend to kill you at that point in your life, your early 60s, when you're beginning to become burdensome to the healthcare system. And the deaths that cigarettes cause, including lung cancer, are often relatively inexpensive deaths. actually, I've urged the tobacco industry to start a campaign in this way. Support cigarette smoking. It contains health care costs by killing people. So it's not obvious that if everybody stopped smoking, health care costs would go down. I still am in favor of the sin taxes, not because it will lower costs, but because it will save lives. I think we have to focus on the benefit side of this equation, not on the cost side of the equation.
You predict chaos in the future. Why are you so pessimistic?
Well, I think that we're going to get a health care plan. I'm not sure about this. Yogi Berra said, never make predictions, especially not about the future. But I'm afraid that the current round of health care reform will produce a relatively incoherent incremental set of changes which will not, in fact, address the underlying problems, and that the result of this will be continued rapid increase in health care costs, a continued decrease in coverage so that more Americans are uninsured and more Americans are incompletely insured, and that it will only be after the failure of the current round of reform is obvious in 5 or 6 years that we then come back around to trying to get universal coverage. And it seems to me some of the people I talk to in Washington say to me that they agree that really a universal payroll tax finance system is the way to go, but they don't think they have the political support to do that, so that, you know, in the spirit of the great is the enemy of the good, they're going to try to establish universal coverage now, and even if they do it in a structurally and financially incoherent way, they'll establish the principle and hope to fix it up later. Well, the difficulty with that is that the American public's faith in government, it seems to me, is not particularly high. And to embark on a plan which, in your heart, you're really pretty doubtful is going to work, runs the risk of only increasing the cynicism of the American public about the capacity of government to solve problems. And if we really do know what to do, then I think we ought to take the risk now of trying to actually do the right thing. Indeed, if I were an industrial leader and I thought about all the hassles that health insurance had caused me in recent years, I mean, health care is now the leading cause of strikes in the United States because health care costs, the premiums we were talking about, are rising so fast that they're sopping up all the money corporations have available to give to wage increases, and it's really created a lot of union management difficulty. If I were a businessman, I would be really enthusiastic about a universal system. Think about having this incredible pain in the neck be somebody else's responsibility and not have to worry about it anymore. So I think that despite the political wisdom which says even with the trade-in for decreased health insurance premiums, Americans will not confront new taxes. That's impossible. The administration can't put forward a universal plan. People are too suspicious of government. All the arguments against doing the right thing, which are political, I think that with enough leadership, we might actually be able to do the right thing.
Mark Roberts is a professor of political economy and health policy at the Harvard School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, how are you following yesterday's murder of a Florida doctor who performed abortions?
We're doing a series of stories about that. We have an interview with Randall Terry of Operation Rescue. Paz Cohen is following up on demands by abortion rights activists that the FBI treat this in the same way they did violence in the civil rights movement. And we will talk to a doctor who performs abortions and is concerned about what happens next. We also are following the president's attempts to spend some money to convert defense jobs and defense plants to peacetime uses.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new rap comedy CB4 is an unusual collaboration. It was co-written by journalist Nelson George and Saturday Night Live performer Chris Rock, who also stars in the film. The director, Tamara Davis, also made the independent film Gun Crazy, but that's not why she was hired to make CB4. She's best known for her rock and rap videos for Lou Reed, Bette Midler, Tone Loc, Young MC, and Sonic Youth. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
CB4 is a ramshackle parody of rap music, with a ridiculous storyline, brainless songs, terrible acting, and inept direction. I had a pretty good time. Now, I have to admit that rap is not my favorite form of recreation. I loved it when it first appeared in the late 70s, but 15 years later, it strikes me as only slightly fresher than, say, the Jefferson Airplane. It's become a boring youth classic, like heavy metal. But heavy metal has already enjoyed a definitive parody at the hands of Rob Reiner's movie This Is Spinal Tap, so rap's come up and seems long overdue. CB4 isn't nearly of Spinal Tap caliber, but it delivers a lot of the necessary goods. Very funny parodies, for instance, of the classic rap videos of people like Hammer and LL Cool J. Very funny comments on the exaggerated toughness of so many gangster rappers. And very funny lampoons of certain other aspects of black life. My favorite is the rap star named Dead Mike, who becomes infected with Afrocentrism and starts delivering profound statements like, "Did you know that a black man invented ice cream?" And, "If you spell white man backwards, what does it spell? Pork." Then there's Chris Elliott, who plays the fawning white filmmaker who's trying to document the rise to stardom of the new rap trio CB4. When he shows the band parts of his film, their response is something less than enthusiastic.
"Hey, why don't we hire this other man instead of the brother man? Because the other man is much cheaper than the brother man."
"Guys, what I need, what my documentary is missing, is really, it's quite simple. I need to know who Cell Block 4 really is. I mean, I want to know how you guys think. Do you guys like sandwiches? Do you guys like fondue? I mean, I'd like to know that. How do you guys sleep at night?"
"Ew, I'm out of here, man. You clown."
"Hey, wait, where are you going?"
What did I say?
"Yo, chill. I'm gonna let him hang out with me today, all right?"
That's Chris Rock there at the end, offering Elliot a day of thrills. He plays a middle-class kid named Albert Brown, who's been trying forever to put together a decent rap act. When a local gangster named Gusto gets busted and sent to jail, Albert takes on his persona, calling himself MC Gusto, and naming his band CB4 after the real Gusto's new address, Cell Block 4. As you might expect, the real Gusto finds out about Albert's ruse and breaks out of prison to take his revenge. That's what amounts in this movie to a plot. And it might have worked if Albert, as MC Gusto, even remotely resembled the real gangster Gusto. But he doesn't. His clothes are different. His hair is different. His sunglasses are different. The filmmakers keep telling us what their movie's about, but nothing on the screen indicates that they've got it right. There are other subplots, too, all equally unconvincing. But it doesn't matter much. CB4 is a brief, painless, mildly enjoyable dip into hip-hop and youth culture. So who cares if it makes Wayne's World look like Lawrence of Arabia?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about gangs in Los Angeles with a man who tries to keep them from wiping each other out, L.A. County Probation Officer Jim Gallipo. He started working with gang members after the Watts riots. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.